I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. We are following the tragic and horrifying mass shooting in Las Vegas and are working on a show for tomorrow once we know more and can have a productive conversation. The president will be speaking later this morning, which WHYY will carry. President Trump claims that his administration's new tax plan is good for the middle class. Here he is speaking in Indianapolis last week.
This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity, and I guess it's probably something I could say that I'm very good at. I've been waiting for this for a long time. We're going to cut taxes for the middle class, make the tax code simpler and more fair for everyday Americans, and we are going to bring back the jobs and wealth that have left our country, and most people thought left our country for good.
The Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center said not so fast. While federal taxes would be reduced by $1,600 for the average taxpayer, the top 1% would receive most of the benefits. The proposal, which is short on details, reduces the corporate tax rate and the top income tax rate, gets rid of the estate tax and the alternative minimum tax. It shrinks the number of tax brackets, basically doubles the standard deduction, and gets rid of some other deductions. Today, we want to take apart the GOP tax plan, its effect on the taxpayers, the debt, and the overall economy. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Michael Knoll. He's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, where he also co-directs the Center for Tax Law and Policy, also a professor of real estate at the Wharton School. Michael Knoll, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Nice to have you here. And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Benjamin Applebaum. He's Washington correspondent for The New York Times. And Benjamin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here.
Let me begin with you, Benjamin. Who's right, the president or the Tax Policy Center, as it stands today?
So, you know, who's right depends a little bit on how you think the economy works. What is clear about this tax plan, there's sort of two halves to it. Part of it is a change in the way that we tax individual income. And as far as that goes, the middle class wouldn't really see any big savings. The way that this plan is structured is that it changes a little bit the way that we assess those taxes, but there aren't huge changes in the amount of money that people would pay. The benefits of this plan really depend on the other half, which is a really big reduction in the taxation of business income. And proponents of this idea say two things about it as far as benefiting the middle class. The first is that they argue that when a corporation pays less money in taxes, it is going to spend more of that money on wages, and so the employees of those companies will see a direct benefit. And the second is that reducing corporate taxation stimulates economic activity. It encourages companies to make investments, buy new equipment, build new factories, and that too increases the general prosperity. So if there's going to be a benefit to the middle class, that is where the benefit is. Those ideas, however, are very controversial. A lot of economists have significant questions about the ability of this plan to perform those goals, not least because the economy is already growing. So The idea that the Trump administration is going to make it grow faster seems dubious to a lot of people.
I want to pick up on several things, but let me get you in on the conversation, Michael Knoll. Broadly speaking, and it should be said, this is an outline, so there are a lot of details that are not here. But what is your assessment?
Well, I mean, that's absolutely right. It's very much an outline or a framework is what they're calling it. And so it makes it hard to really know in terms of, especially on the individual side, who's going to pay more, who's going to get tax cuts. But on the corporate side, there's a little more sense of what's going on, or the business side.
Because of the corporate tax rate.
The corporate tax rate.
35 to 20.
And I think there's a fair amount of consensus among economists that our headline rate is too high, that we're out of line with much of the rest of the world, especially the OECD, and we need to bring it down. Now, that, of course, costs revenue, and so the revenue needs to be made up somewhere. So I think there's some aspects of this of which there would be general agreement. And as Benjamin is saying, that seems to be the biggest sort of piece of it.
But it is interesting that at least it's being touted. I mean, We've got the president. We're going to hear from Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, saying this is for the middle class.
Well, I guess they're trying to maybe they're trying to say two things. One is, as Binyamin is saying, is that improving the competitiveness of the U.S. economy will benefit the middle class.
Is that called trickle down?
Well, I don't know if that's so much trickle down. Was more the idea of really the tax cuts for the wealthy as opposed to on the business side. And it's fair to say there's some trickle down here. There may be a lot of trickle down. There may be much less trickle down. The problem is we know so little about really what the ultimate plan is as opposed to this broad framework. It's hard to know to the extent, you know, are lower and middle class folks going to get a cut? Are they going to keep the promise to make sure that we don't reduce the progressivity of the tax system? There are a couple of things here which would suggest no. Mm. Eliminating the estate tax, for example.
Which is largely for wealthy people.
Well, it's exclusively for,
yes.
for wealthy people.
Not the family farm necessarily.
Right. And unless it's worth at least $5 million plus. And then the pass-through rules, which could benefit, you know, they often talk about lower and middle class in terms of small businesses, but the overwhelming benefit to that is likely to be at the high end. So it's hard to say at this stage.
Let me play, and Binyamin, I'll get back to you. This is Secretary of the Treasury Steve Mnuchin. He's speaking to George Stephanopoulos yesterday on This Week about whether this is a tax cut for the middle class or not. Let's give it a listen.
But you can't guarantee that all middle class individuals will receive a tax cut, can you? Some will get a tax increase.
No, it is our objective that the entire middle class does get a tax cut. And that's something we're working on the details. As you said, you can't make guarantees because every single person's taxes are different. People take advantage of different things. So we can't make that guarantee, but we can say that's our objective and that's what we're working to. And we want to protect the middle class.
Objective, is that the operative word, Binyamin?
I mean, it's fine for them to talk about objectives, but at some point plans need to have details. That's how they get implemented. Some of the details that the administration has disclosed to this point are that part of this plan is to eliminate a couple of the deductions that particularly benefit middle class and upper middle class families. Those include the deduction you get for having children, the deduction you get for paying state and local taxes, which is a particularly big deal in what are often called blue states, which tend to have higher state level and local level taxation. So if you eliminate those, the question is, what prevents taxes from rising on the middle class? One potential answer is that they may reduce the rates of taxation on income for at least some families, although they have not been clear about those details. Another potential answer is a plan to increase the standard deduction that everyone gets to take right off the bat. And a third is something called the child tax credit, which could offset some of the money they're taking away from the existing child deductions. That all sounds very confusing. The bottom line is basically this. To this point, the administration has outlined a plan that has the potential to increase taxation on the personal income of many middle-class families. If they are going to achieve the objective that Secretary Mnuchin described, mm-hmm. they will need to disclose additional details about this plan that are not yet public and may not yet be determined.
But can we assume that that's what Congress and the administration are going to grapple with over the next couple of months?
I think it is certainly what they're going to need to grapple with, not least because as currently structured, this tax plan probably would raise taxes on a significant number of the members of Congress, and it seems unlikely to command a majority as long as it's going to do that.
Michael, you want to jump in on that?
No, I would absolutely agree. I mean, we really need the details. I think it goes to the House. And the real question, which is nothing I claim any expertise in, is really going to be politics and a question of who's on board and who mm-hmm. wants to play, who's prepared to play ball and negotiate. And that's really going to determine where this is going to come out.
And Binyamin, I'm assuming the lobbyists are lining up to make their case?
And one thing that's really interesting about that is precisely because there's mm-hmm. such an absence of detail in this plan, it's a wonderful sales opportunity for lobbyists because they can go to their clients mm-hmm. and basically say, it's dark and there are monsters in the room and you can't possibly be sure who they are or what they want to do to you. You better pay us a lot of money to protect you. So this bill, precisely because it's so ambiguous at this point, is just an absolute windfall for the lobbying industry.
And if I can, my guess is, based on history in 86, is...
And that's the last time,
I guess. Sorry, that was the last time there was a major tax reform. And we may get into whether or not this is or is not major tax reform or just a little working around the edges and cutting some rates, is that many industries sort of lined up against reform until the ball started to get rolling. So the lobbyists are being hired, but they're protecting basically to fight. And then once the ball starts to get rolling, more and more people who are fighting saying, look, this looks like it may go the other way. We can't just continue to say no. We've got to now protect your interest and get your piece of the pie. And that's sort of often the way the lobbying sort of develops, assuming we ever get to that second stage.
Well, you raise an interesting point, whether tax cuts equal tax reform. Can you answer your own question, Michael?
Well, the view among tax experts is no, is tax reform is really the idea of really reworking parts of the system, and generally for the reason that people think aspects don't work very well. This is, on the individual side, it tends to be complexity and poor incentives in certain places. On the business side, it's really in terms of sort of investment and money kept overseas and incentives for companies to leave. They're doing some things on the second part, the business and international. I think on the business side, most people agree that rates need to be reduced. International, there's a debate. And they've, I think, are suggesting a compromise in that debate between the people who don't want to tax foreign income of U.S. corporations and those who do without deferral, but they'll do it at a reduced rate and they'll take some money out of what's sitting there. Those are all on the table, and I think people would think are good moves, tax experts. The first, which most people care about, there's not all that much done, and it's incredibly unclear, and even some of the there's some minimal justification of simplification, but there's not a lot of simplification here.
I'm looking at this corporate tax rate, and Benjamin, we're almost about a break here, but do any corporations pay 35% today?
I mean, there may be corporations that do, but it would be extraordinarily unusual, and they should probably fire their accountants. Can I just say a quick word about tax reform versus tax cuts? I think there's a lot of confusion about that terminology. The distinction that listeners should have in mind is that tax cuts are when the government is reducing the total amount of money that it collects. Tax reform is any change in the tax code that makes the tax code better for the economy. That's really the distinction people should have in mind.
Well, that's maybe the individual. I mean, in terms of broadly, often you do reduce taxes, and they always seem to be reducing them. It's been a long time, I guess, since we've raised them, in spite of fiscal concerns. We like to think of reform as not just small little changes, but really of redoing the tax system in sort of significant ways, which internationally we might do here.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Michael Knoll. He's co-director of the Center for Tax Law and Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Benjamin Applebaum joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. He's Washington correspondent for The New York Times. We are talking about the proposed changes to the tax code, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Last week, the Trump administration announced the outline of their tax plan, saying it would be a big benefit to the middle class. Talking with Michael Knoll and Benjamin Applebaum. And you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Michael, you wanted to say something just briefly about corporations and those who actually do pay closer to the 35%.
Right. Multinational corporations tend to pay very low tax rates if they're U.S.-based because they strip money out. They basically take profits in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world and tend to move them to low-tax jurisdictions. But corporations, even sizable ones that are U.S.-based and pretty much exclusively in the United States, Walgreens, for example, and other retailers tend to pay pretty high taxes. They don't have the ability to do that. So for those corporations, it's seen as a big advantage to reduce the headline tax rate.
Benjamin, do you want to add to that? Otherwise, I have a whole bunch of other questions to put out here.
Yeah, you know, I guess I'd just note about that, that it's worth thinking about, you know, who is advantaged by these changes. It is clear that retailers would like to pay lower taxes. The argument that that has broader benefits for the rest of us is very different in that case. When it's a multinational that has the ability to move its business overseas, the case is basically if we tax them too much here, they're going to relocate more of their activity to other countries.
Right.
When we're talking about businesses that are essentially trapped here, you need to make some case that reducing their taxes is actually good for the rest of us.
Well, we do want to encourage investment here, and it discourages investment here by those companies, by other companies that would be here. And it does create this odd sense where we encourage companies to become multinational so they could strip the money out. Indeed, Walgreens did talk about doing an inversion with Boot, but that was basically shut down by political pressure. So we've got this discrimination or inconsistency in how we're taxing companies based on their ability to withstand political pressure or not.
Benjamin, getting back to something you said earlier in the hour about whether by giving corporations a lesser tax rate and also reducing the top income tax rate for wealthy Americans, will that be good for the economy? And perhaps it's too soon to tell. But is that does that result in investments and hiring people and the kind of wages that you wage increases that you mentioned earlier?
So this is hotly debated among economists. There's sort of an intuitive sense in which you might think if there's going to be a lower tax rate, then it's going to reward activity. And so they reduce tax rates that affect mm-hmm. investment, surely corporations will invest more. There's a couple of contextual issues to keep in mind. The first is that a lot of things factor into a business's decision about whether to build, say, a new factory. The potential profitability, the market demand, the, you know, the business's own, you know, outlook for the future. Paul O'Neill, who was George W. Bush's Treasury Secretary, actually resigned early in that administration in protest against a proposal to do something very much like this, because he said, essentially, you know, any businessman who would respond to this by increasing investment is a moron, basically suggesting that, you know, businessmen have other reasons for doing things and minor changes in tax rates would not be the bottom line reason that they would or would not make an investment. There's also a couple points about present circumstances. The economy is growing. The Federal Reserve thinks it's growing about as fast as it can right now. Has even indicated that were the administration to pass a stimulus package, the Fed might seek to offset it by raising interest rates because it doesn't think the economy should be growing more quickly. Corporations are also near their peak of profitability, historically speaking, and they're sitting on a huge amount of money, almost $2 trillion in the pockets of non-financial corporations. So some people look at that and say, listen, if there are investment opportunities, right, companies are going to take them with the money they already have. They don't need additional money to encourage investment.
Does that get us to a discussion, Michael, about consumer spending? I do want to get back to taxes.
You do. I wanted to tackle the $2 trillion, which is a reference to, I think, profits offshore, which actually our tax system as it operates.
No. That's domestic cash on hand. $1.84 trillion in domestic cash on hand.
All right, and one point something in cash on hand offshore.
The so there's a lot of about, cash lying around.
Right, but I guess there are a couple of things going on. I'm not really aware of economists who take the view that our corporate tax system makes a lot of sense, that it's efficient and encouraging or even sort of neutral towards investment, and that cannot be improved significantly. That strikes me, though, as a different question than claims that are often made by politicians and maybe some advocates for these changes of tremendous amounts of economic growth that are going to come from them. I think those are different.
Mm-hmm.
And those certainly haven't been established. And those are often in terms of the arguments these cuts will pay for themselves. I don't think anybody who's seriously engaged in the profession, who's looked at studies that have been done, takes that position. I think they say, look, the system is not very rational. It creates a lot of bad incentives. We ought to and need to clean that up. And in part, that means reducing the tax burden on the corporations. But it'll provide mm-hmm. some benefit, but it'll take over time.
Benjamin, let me go back to you. Does this, at least on paper, today, does this increase the debt?
Yes, absolutely. The administration has not proposed anything like the types of spending cuts that would or the types of new taxes that would be necessary to offset the projected cost of these cuts. The Senate has actually passed enabling legislation that specifically says that this tax bill can add up to $1.5 trillion to the national debt over the next decade. Mm. And it is clear that the math here would cost the government more than it would either recoup from new taxes or offset through spending cuts. So the answer is categorically yes.
I remember Vice President Dick Cheney saying debts or deficits, I think he said, deficits don't matter. Do they matter, Michael Newell?
Oh, definitely. And the numbers are two and a quarter, $2.5 trillion over the next 10 years is the kind of thing. So beyond the $1.5 billion that may be allowed based on the budget that gets passed. And the question is sort of at what point? There's a real concern of crowding out of investment. So you provide a tax cut, but you in essence tell people they're going to have to pay more taxes later. That doesn't encourage the kind of spending that we're looking to encourage. It basically sort of encourages saving to prepare for it and even worse behavior in terms of just trying to bankrupt yourself before the bill comes due.
And Benjamin, I mean, it's interesting, and perhaps this is a more partisan question. When Democrats were in power, all of a sudden the Republicans were opposed to deficits or adding to the debt. How about today?
I think that that's a very commonly misunderstood point. What Dick Cheney meant when he said deficits don't matter anymore is that he was pledging allegiance to a theory called supply-side economics. One of the tenets of that theory is that if a country cuts taxes and raises interest rates, it will attract foreign investment sufficiently to allow it to finance its government debt. And so there won't be huge fiscal consequences. Cheney felt that that had happened in the 1980s. Japan started pumping huge amounts of money into the American economy. It happened in the 2000s when China pumped huge amounts of money into the American economy. Part of this theory, part of this supply-side economics theory, is that you don't run into the type of crowding Michael was talking about because the available supply of money expands in response to the government's policies.
Well,
now,
and
Republicans have drawn a distinction between deficits that are caused by spending increases and deficits that are caused by tax cuts. That's more of a moral distinction than an economic distinction. They don't like larger government, which is a perfectly valid political argument to be having. But economically speaking, there's no reason to think there's a huge difference.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And that's Benjamin Applebaum, Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Michael Newell with us as well. He's a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, co-director of the Center for Tax Law and Policy. And we are talking this hour of Radio Times about the proposal announced last week by the Trump administration and by the Republicans that would reduce a fair number of taxes. And we are talking about what's in this proposal and its possible consequences. And you can join our conversation, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Something that I noticed, and you both can correct me if I'm wrong, when I went actually to the Tax Policy Institute, it looked like the lowest tax rate, which is now 10%, this is for federal income tax, that would be increased from 10 to 12%. Benjamin, do I have that right? And why? Why would you increase the tax rate on poor people?
So that's correct. But the other important detail there is that the proposal would also increase the standard deduction, the amount that people are allowed to just exclude from taxation right off the bat, and it would raise it above the threshold for the current 10% bracket. So the better way to think of that 12 is that it's a reduction of the next bracket, which is currently at 15. No one would be facing higher taxes purely as a consequence of that individual change. There is a question about, you know, the child tax credits that we touched on earlier and whether any lower income families would face higher taxes as a consequence of the totality of this proposal. But that specific change in the 10 to 12 bracket is a bit misleading. It wouldn't actually hurt anybody under the terms of this proposal.
And Michael, could an argument be made that the wealthy people in this country get a much bigger deduction in their taxes because they pay most of the taxes? The top 20% pay almost 95% of our federal income tax.
I mean, there are always debates on the distribution of the tax burden. And
I mean, the argument is that they can afford it, but nonetheless.
Right. Though there's also a fair amount of pressure, political and otherwise, that believes the system should be more progressive, not less progressive. So that moves in the opposite direction. But it's also sort of complicated because we've got this budget problem. And so something has got to happen to give. And maybe it comes from left field or right field, a little bit of both now, a carbon tax or something. The idea of basically taxing carbon emissions because something needs to make up for the loss of, right. Of revenue.
Benjamin, if you go from five tax brackets mm-hmm. to three, does that mm-hmm. become less or more progressive, or does it change one way or the other?
I think, you know, the exact number of tax brackets, I think, is one of the less significant issues in this debate, even though it commands a lot of public attention. But in general, the progressivity of the American tax structure has been in decline for the last couple of decades. That's in part because we've been flattening income taxation in the way that you just were describing with the tax brackets. It's even in greater part because we've been reducing the role that personal income taxation plays in the total mix of revenues. And also chopping away things like the estate tax or the alternative minimum tax that have the effect of collecting more revenue from the wealthy. So the general trend here is clear. The idea of progressive taxation, and people can debate whether they think that's a good thing, right. but it is less of a thing than it used to be.
What do you think of the estate tax?
Well, I mean, it's clear who benefits from eliminating or the tax or raising where it. I mean, there's certainly arguments to be made that there are better ways to get that money even from the wealthy. But there doesn't seem to be any of that in this plan.
Which basically eliminates the estate tax.
Which eliminates the estate tax and maintains the step up on basis at death. Which is often seen as – so basically what happens if you have highly appreciated property and you keep it until death, your heirs get the property with basis fair market value, then you never pay tax on the gain and the estate tax doesn't capture it either. Right. So one suggestion is get rid of the estate tax but get rid of the step up in basis, and so at some point we will collect right. the tax. You know, that's part of what's to be seen here. It seems unlikely that that's on very likely. But also we still have a question of, is there going to be a higher rate? The framework allows for a fourth rate. Clearly they need it if they're going to get within even the $1.5 trillion, yet alone keep us where we are in right. terms of deficit projections.
Benjamin, obviously we're talking largely about the federal income tax. There's Social Security tax. There's state and local taxes, and on from there. Are Americans taxed more than our counterparts in other parts of the world?
No, we are not. We are actually taxed much less than the citizens of most other developed democratic countries. A big reason for that, of course, is that in many of those countries, healthcare is a government service, whereas in the United States it's paid for privately. So it might make more sense to sort of compare the total amount that we spend on taxes plus the amount we spend on healthcare with the tax structures in other developed democracies. Even then, because Americans spend a lot more on healthcare than do people in most other countries. Yeah. But if the question is purely about how much of our collective income the government takes, the two things to say about it are, number one, it is significantly less than the rest of the developed world. And number two, it has not really been increasing over time. It's been pretty stable. It's not like we're responding to some, you know, new or growing problem here. For the last couple of decades, the government's share of the economy has held pretty stable, measured in its revenues.
Do you see it that way, Michael?
Yeah, no, that's true. Compared, throwing in both state and local as well as federal taxes, that's right. We are definitely on the low end among the OECD countries, the most developed market economy countries.
And picking up something said earlier about if people cannot deduct their state and local taxes, how would that specifically affect people living here in the Delaware Valley, whether Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware?
Right. Well, you only get to deduct your state and local taxes if what you're doing is you're itemizing your deductions. State and local taxes is one of the major deductions for those who itemize. It tends to be concentrated, not surprisingly, in high-tax states. It also tends to hit the well-to-do much more so than the middle class. About 30% of people itemize, and almost all of them take the state and local deduction. That tends to be the top three deciles in terms of income.
Are we considered?
And we are.
I was going to say Pennsylvania and New Jersey.
Yeah, one way is to look at the states. But even with the states, Pennsylvania, really, it's going to be concentrated around Philly and the Philly suburbs and Pittsburgh and the Pittsburgh sort of suburbs. So it tends to be concentrated in high income, tend to be blue states, but often in the cities and the wealthy areas, which, frankly, from a political standpoint, are more of a mix in terms of being some Republican, some Democrat.
Yeah, certainly the Philly suburbs. Benjamin, anything you want to add to that?
I think one of the really interesting things about this tax plan as it's currently laid out is that there's a good chance that the people who will fare worst are sort of the upper middle class, people with high incomes who don't own their own businesses, New York Times readers, for lack of a better term. they're the people who have the least obvious benefits from this tax plan and the most potential costs. Is that sort of, you know, if you want to think of it as like the 90 to 99th percentiles of the income distribution, that's where the burden falls most heavily here.
But I would think those people have a fair amount of political clout. Benjamin, almost up in a break here.
They do. And the other thing about them is that that group also includes many of the members of Congress, as I mentioned earlier. So it's just a little hard to imagine Congress writing a tax plan that ends up, you know, hurting Congress at the end of the day.
That is Benjamin Applebaum, again, Washington correspondent for The New York Times. We are talking about the GOP, Trump administration tax plan that was unveiled. It's short on details, but there are lots of things to talk about. Also with us, Michael Knoll, and he is a co-director of the Center for Tax Law and Policy at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are talking about the tax proposal that was announced last week. President Trump discussing it at an event, in Indianapolis last Wednesday.
Our framework includes our explicit commitment that tax reform will protect low-income and middle-income households, not the wealthy and well-connected. They can call me all they want. It's not going to help. I'm doing the right thing, and it's not good for me, believe me.
Benjamin, how would we know that?
You should not believe him. He is not telling the truth about that. It is very clear that Donald Trump would personally benefit from this plan in a couple of respects. The elimination of estate taxation, only a couple thousand families each year are subject to estate taxation. Donald Trump, his estate is in that category. He is also, the type of taxpayer who falls under the alternative minimum tax, which is a safety net that was basically created to limit tax avoidance by the wealthy. The 1 year of his tax returns that have come into public view in 2005 show that his taxes owed that year were increased by $31 million as a result of the alternative minimum tax. So he is exactly the kind of person who is caught in that particular net. He is also the owner of pass-through businesses. Most companies in America are no longer incorporated and subject to that 35% tax rate we were talking about earlier. They are instead pass-throughs, which means that the income they earn is passed through to the individual owner's tax returns and taxed at the rates to which they are subject as individuals. This proposal would reduce the tax rate for that income to 25%, a maximum of 25%. That's a huge savings for the owners of those kinds of businesses. That includes a lot of mom and pops. It also includes a lot of huge real estate partnerships, investment partnerships, law firms. Very large companies can be structured in that way and would benefit significantly from this proposal. So on several levels, people like Donald Trump are indeed the largest beneficiaries of this plan.
Do we know how many pass-through entities he has?
his holdings are incredibly complicated, and I don't have it at my fingertips, but it would probably take more than one radio show to unpack all of them.
Wow, wow. Mike, you want to wait? I know you wanted to talk about this pass-through tax.
Yeah, I don't remember the number, but I don't remember whether it was hundreds or thousands of sort of pass-through.
I saw 500, but sometimes
okay.
I don't
it, all right,
trust
so it wasn't that range. One more thing I want to add. I absolutely agree with everything Binyamin has said here about Trump's returns. Except what we have is we don't have his returns from 1 year. We have one page, I think, or one page from 1 year and one page of one return from another year. So we really have very little information. And he is one of the major players in this. And that is really sort of extraordinary for him to be able to play a major role, and for people to be able to sort of negotiate with him and have a serious conversation as to who and what is benefiting, and to try to come up with some sort of plan, whether it's a major or a minor plan at the end of the day, and for not to sort of see how it affects him, just makes him makes it a very uncomfortable sort of negotiation. And I think for people who are skeptical and not incredibly supportive of the president, it's going to make it very hard for them to come to the table and to make any sort of deal, which I think is really unfortunate. I mean, I think this is important stuff, and I think it would benefit greatly from having the president lay those cards on the table and wherever they fall, and then sort of argue as to why we should take one path or another.
Well, Benjamin, I mean, what is it? It seems that the president has given no indication that he is going to release his tax returns.
I see no reason to believe that they will be forthcoming through his agency.
And this is really unprecedented, isn't it, Benjamin?
Modern presidents have uniformly shared that information with the public, yes. For him to be withholding his tax returns has no precedent in the modern era.
And now that we're sitting there and we're going to talk about tax reform, it comes just more to the head.
Is there any pressure, Benjamin, coming from the Republicans on the president on this issue?
I have not seen any indication that the Republican Party feels that way. You know, we haven't talked much about this, but I think the real precedents for what we're seeing right now are not so much the 1986 tax reform, but the 1981 and 2001 tax cut packages passed in the first year of the Reagan and Bush presidencies, respectively. Huh. And one thing that's interesting when you go back and look at the history of it is that Ronald Reagan's personal tax returns were a big issue during that debate. People were aware that he was wealthy. People were aware that he stood to be a beneficiary of these changes, and they talked about it, and it informed the debate. And in the end, they decided to pass the measures that they wanted to pass. But the information was in public view, and people were able to think about it in the context of the debate.
And that's worth a whole nother hour as well. Let me get a couple of callers in. I have some comments as well. We have Bill, and he's calling us from Wayne. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hey, my question's around the trickle-down economics theory. Both David Stockman on his blog and just last week, Bruce Bartlett, both co-architects of the Reagan trickle-down theory have completely rejected that as simply a thought experiment. I mean, have the Republicans been inculcated through a hypernormalization of terminology to believe this is the case, that, you know, this actually works, and even though it's to be proven otherwise? Thanks.
Bill, thanks for the call. Michael, let me toss that back to you, but I'm sure, Benjamin, we touched on this earlier about whether this is trickle-down and whether trickle-down actually works.
Yeah, I don't know. Is it trickle down? I mean, it definitely looks different than the idea of just slashing rates at the top, and the idea that people are going to then start spending the money creating jobs. But there is a little bit of a sense of that, perhaps with the pass-throughs more than anywhere else. And that's a pretty sort of confused piece, because it basically says for those pass-through entities, all of those sort of businesses that you were talking about, the income will now be taxed at a lower rate of 25%. And it's hard to think that many people think there's going to be a big increase in those businesses. There's going to be a lot of effort to fall within the 25 rather than in the 35 or perhaps higher. It's not clear how those lines can be drawn well or not. So I don't know whether I call that trickle down or not, but I think it's going to be a real problem and a nightmare. And it's not at all clear how they're going to set up those rules and how they're going to be enforced.
But it seems, Benjamin, it is being at least partially sold as this is going to grow the economy. And that's why we don't need to worry about adding to the debt.
That's absolutely right. You know, the premise of supply-side economics is that what you are doing when you cut taxes or restructure the tax code is that you are encouraging investment. That's why it's beneficial for the economy to have that money in private hands, is because those private individuals are more likely to invest. It has always been a key part of that theory that it is the wealthy who are more likely to invest. They have more resources to invest. They're more able to cover their basic needs. And so in that sense, I mean, whether or not you want to call this trickle-down is right. Sort of a semantic argument, but it is clear that the purpose of this is to give the wealthy more money to invest, which it is said will have economic mm-hmm. benefits. The key point about Bartlett and Stockman, one of the places that they both broke from this approach to economics, is a concern about the deficit. They argued essentially that if you don't simultaneously make spending cuts, the harm of having a larger deficit will offset the benefits of having lower taxes. And that question of how important deficits are is really a defining break within that camp of people who think that lower taxes are beneficial.
Because you're going to pay more money to pay down that debt slash deficit.
Because the government needs to soak up more of the available resources. So even if people have more money to invest, more of it's just going right back to the government, which needs to borrow to cover its costs.
Bill, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Mike sent us an email saying, please discuss in light of the recent experiment in Kansas, and I don't know whether this computes or not. Benjamin?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, this is directly relevant.
Yeah, go ahead, Kansas, Benjamin.
So we were talking about pass-through businesses, the idea that, you know, many people operate businesses where the income comes through to their personal tax returns. Kansas basically said, we are going to slash those rates on pass-through business income. And what happened is that people in Kansas started becoming businesses. So instead of Benjamin Applebaum, you would be talking today to Benjamin Applebaum LLC,
right.
And my pay would go to this LLC, and as a consequence, I would pay much less in taxes. So the head coach of the Kansas basketball team became a company, that old Jay-Z line, I'm a businessman, you know. The head of the Kansas football team became a company, and as a consequence, paid much less in taxes. The state had projected in classic supply-side fashion that this would be good for Kansas. It turned out to be an absolute disaster. Republicans there have now voted to start rolling it back. They've done something. It's been since 1990 since a congressional Republican voted in favor of a tax increase. But in Kansas, there are now Republicans mm-hmm. at the state level who are in favor of tax increases because this grand experiment went horribly awry.
You see it that way, Michael?
Well, I didn't know, one, you were paying for interviews, but let me put that,
no,
that
we,
aside.
Let me just say, we do not pay for interviews. Okay,
and
we'll put that to rest.
But that is really... the Kansas, right, certainly didn't work. They understood. The challenge here is, can they, given that if they want to reduce the tax rate in this way, can they draw a line that basically prevents Benjamin and me from becoming businesses and then right. contracting with our employers, in which case all it does is it reduces our taxes. There's no new investment or anything. And that is a real challenge. It's a real question. And, you know, people aren't sure because Kansas wasn't able to do it. And one doesn't think it's just really the lack of will. Mm-hmm. It's because this is what tax lawyers and accountants spend their time doing, basically. And
figuring this stuff out.
And that's not growth. That's basically waste. That's sort of forced full employment rather than productive employment.
Benjamin, do the Democrats have any ideas on this particular issue?
So, you know, this has been a big problem for a long time because Republicans have insisted that any corporate tax reform needs to deal with this issue of pass-through income, and Democrats have been reluctant to do it because they note that the vast majority of that income flows through to people who are very affluent, and they think it should be taxed at the higher personal rates. And so finding a way out of that dilemma of how do you, on the one hand, treat businesses, all kinds of businesses, equally, and on the other hand, make sure that the tax code remains progressive, it's a really difficult challenge. I've not heard Democrats articulate, any solutions to it.
And even more broadly speaking, Benjamin, do the Democrats have their counter proposal to what the Republicans are offering?
Yeah. So, and Michael has made this point a couple of times. There is a broad consensus that our corporate tax code is broken. It allows some companies to pay almost nothing. It requires others to pay much more. It's unbelievably complicated. Yep. Pretty much everyone except the accountants themselves would like us to spend less money on tax accounting. And it clearly is deleterious to economic growth in various ways. And so there is a broad consensus among Democrats that it would be a wonderful thing to rework and simplify the corporate tax code, to reduce the top line rates, to make them more competitive with other countries. That's not a controversial issue. The two controversies are primarily about should you be offering a huge personal income tax cut at this moment in history, and should you be seeking to offset the cost of this package in some way, either with new taxes or with spending cuts.
Or with spending cuts. And that, of course, talk about the devil in the details. Mm-hmm. How about for you, Michael, I tossed this to you during the break about if there is consensus, and clearly there is, that what we have now is overly complicated and doesn't really support an economy in the 21st century. What are some of the minor or even major changes that you would look for?
You can think of it in terms of either sort of the business side or the personal side. On the personal side, where I think the biggest sort of pushes would be to move more towards a consumption tax of some sort. So maybe it's even to do more in terms of raising the standard deductions and taking more people off the rolls, and doing more with a value-added tax.
Oh, like Europe.
Like Europe. And then to some degree tweaking with maybe negative income tax on the lower ends and then a higher income tax on the higher end. Republicans and Democrats have generally been a little reluctant. The Republican worry is that upping those taxes, which there's some evidence for when they're introduced in other countries. And the Democrats are concerned very much, I think, with it's a flat tax, essentially, so it reduces progressivity very much. If there's some way to agree on those pieces, I think on the personal side, that is what most academics and economists would support.
How do you see that, Benjamin?
I think that's a good description. I mean, consumption taxation is one of these things that economists love as a theoretical construct. They just think, you know, everything they know about the world tells them that it's the way to go. Politically, it's been a complete non-starter in the United States, although many other developed nations use it as their primary or as a complementary tax system. Here, you know, consumption tax is the best example here. Sales taxes are heavily used at state and local levels, but at the federal level, they play an extremely minor role in the revenue mix.
Benjamin, we're almost out of time here. So what happens next? This proposal was announced last week. What happens going forward?
The ball is in Congress's court now. The House and the Senate need to find a plan they both can live with. It needs to fit within that budget constraint we talked about earlier. The accountants need to agree that it fits under that $1.5 trillion price tag. Whether that's a completely legitimate accounting system or not, those are the rules of the game. And they need to build a consensus among Republicans. Ultimately, this faces the same challenge as healthcare. The burden is on Republicans to reach a consensus. Democrats can't stop them if they do.
Benjamin Applebaum, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times, talking about taxes on the radio. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And he's Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Michael Knoll, thank you for coming in as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's co-director of the Center for Tax Law and Policy at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri, whose birthday is today. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.